Hello everyone, this is Space Cafe Podcast, and I am Marcus. This time, my friends, I'm taking you way up north, all the way to Iceland, that beautiful and wild place, as we all know it. But you know what? Honestly, if you look closely, this place is not that far up north you could imagine. I mean, I'm taking an atlas right now. I'm following with my left index finger as we speak on this atlas right now, the latitudes. And I'm going east and I'm starting in Iceland and I'm passing Bergen, which is sort of halfway in the middle of Norway. Then I'm passing the southern or the lower third of Finland. And then all the way east, I'm passing Anchorage in Alaska. So it's kind of strange, isn't it? Of course, this is a super Eurocentric point of view, but I'm taking advantage of me being here right in the middle of Europe. And you could get a completely different impression of where things are on the globe. By the way, I was once totally astonished and sort of beaten off the track, if I may say, when I suddenly realized that New York lies at the height of Naples or Madrid or Portugal. Or take Los Angeles. It's at the latitude of Israel or North Africa. So maybe please excuse my ignorance here. My worldview doesn't seem to fit the real one out there. I guess it's time to go back to school. Anyways, the reason for our trip today, my friends, is the very director of the Icelandic Space Agency, who, how could it be otherwise in this beautiful country, does not really fit the stereotypes of agencies, and that's what makes him so exciting. What do you Icelanders drink?
I would love grog. Actually, I would love mead right now. But no, this is just a triple espresso.
Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Daniel Leib, the director of the Icelandic National Space Agency.
I'm ready, yeah.
Dan, is the closest one can come to settling down on Mars and encountering aliens on Mars by moving to Iceland as an American?
No question about it. No question about that. You know, in fact, at the Millennium celebrations that were taking place all over the globe, there was a specific group of individuals that believed that aliens were going to land in Iceland at the top of Snæfellsjökull Glacier.
Wow.
Take them to another dimension. So they all came here on right before midnight, 1999, and they went up to the top of Snæfellsjökull Glacier, which incidentally is the volcano glacier that Jules Verne placed his journey to the center of the Earth from. That's where they entered. And they went to the top of that glacier, and they waited, and they waited, and they're still there.
So, was it Icelanders or crazy Americans?
It definitely was not Icelanders. I can tell you.
Awesome. So, how is life in Iceland for you? You've been in this place now for quite a while, but you're still born in America in the United States.
Yes, that's right.
How is life in Iceland?
Well,
for an outsider.
Well, you know, for me now, I mean, Iceland is very much my home. This is where my family is. This is where my daughters are. My wife is Icelandic. My daughters are Icelandic, and you know, this is the country that I've adopted and that I love. But there's no question that it's a big difference from growing up and living prior in Brooklyn, New York City, It is as perhaps as different as one can get. But it's a good difference. And it's a difference that I very much appreciate. And whether it's my family here, friends, colleagues who I have the honor of working with here in Iceland, I've never really felt like I have to go back. You know, I feel as though I perhaps should have been here sooner. So I'm very happy to be here and call Iceland home.
Last name is still Leib, or is it Danielsson?
Well, my daughter's name is Danielsson, Daniel's daughter, actually. My last name is Leib. There was a consideration of whether I changed my last name to Josephson. My father's name was Joseph. So if I was raised here, my last name would be Josephson. But my last name is Leib. My daughter's last name is Daniel's daughter.
So it's true that there is no last name in Iceland. So it's very easy to, but how do you keep track? Because I could imagine there is a bunch of Daniels, producing Daniel's sons and Daniel daughters. So how does that work?
Well, family units here are very strong. So, it's not untypical to have family gatherings where there are multiple generations and all the cousins and all the uncles are together, and people are constantly asking, "Oh, you're related to so and so," and da 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 da. So so people have a pretty fantastic handling of their family trees. So that's one factor. Another really awesome component is Icelandabók, or the Book of Icelanders, which tracks and keeps a record of all Icelanders through hundreds of years. In fact, since the beginning of settlement, you can trace many people, many individuals can actually trace their family back to the settlement, and even before, to the Norse kings in Europe. So the opportunity that Icelanders have to understand and really appreciate their own family trees are something the likes of which I never thought was possible. But yeah, it's not uncommon for someone to be able to trace their family 9 generations back here. And it is something that's discussed, so I might as well get ahead of it. That yes, if two people meet in a bar, and they want to make sure first they're not related, they can check that book beforehand. It's not as common as people like to, you know, people love saying that. It's not that common, although it happens. I mean, you meet somebody and you're like, "Oh, I want to find out if, you know, are they actually related to?" So it's a fun thing that you can do and learn really about, your friend's history and how they're connected to you and vice versa.
I guess there's an app for that, because just to make sure in a bar, if you're investing in the right person, just to make sure that, yeah, it doesn't go wrong.
Yes. There is an app for that. Yes.
How did you end up in Iceland?
Yeah, good question.
You had a wild ride to get there.
I did. You know, when I was very young, my father used to read stories to my brother and I from all over the globe. And I remember distinctly when he started reading some stories from the Icelandic sagas. And it was something that stuck, something that kind of captured my imagination. And I had maybe done some book reports when I was in grade school as a fourth grader, or what have you. But I hadn't really thought about it until I went to university. And I started planning with some friends a trip to go to Iceland. And I started doing all this research about it. And then all of a sudden, 10 of our friends all decided they wanted to go to Iceland. And when it came time to get the tickets, I was the only one who couldn't go. So everybody else went without me. And I said, oh, I have to work on my junior degree project, but sure. I just didn't have the money for the travel at the time. So everybody went, came back with photos and stories, and I just kind of kicked the dirt and, you know, figured, well, one day. But eventually I graduated. I moved back to New York City. And I ran into a friend of mine randomly one day while I was delivering a package, I believe. And she said, Dan, I was just thinking about you because, you know, I'm the creative director of this magazine. And part of my responsibility is managing the magazine while it's on press. And I hate doing that part of the job. And I remembered, Dan Lieb, he was so good with color and kind of OCD and neurotic. And, you know, he would be the perfect person for this. And then here you are, you walk in the door. And I said, well, thank you for that. Appreciate the compliment, I guess. So what is this job exactly? Well, you would come with me and you'd see what I do. And if it works out, managing this magazine while it's on press, if it works out, we'll send you every 2 months. I said, okay, well, where do you print the magazine? She said, Iceland. Didn't you always want to go to Iceland? So that is what initially got me coming to Iceland every 2 months for about 3 years. And over that period of time, made a lot of very close friends here in Iceland. And from the moment I landed, I really felt as though I was at home. I really felt like this is a place that I could live, that I could see myself living. And
how difficult is it to make friends in Iceland?
Yeah, I wouldn't say that with regards to Iceland. I felt as though it was very easy for me to meet and become friends with a lot of people from a lot of different walks of life here. From very early on, I had friends who were bankers. I had friends who were artists and musicians. And I think that also it's about the cultural fabric of Iceland and also the size of the country. You know, there even today there are only like 365,000 people. The city of Reykjavik is cosmopolitan. It's much more cosmopolitan now than it was back in 2002. But you have a mix of lots of different people from different walks of life. And, you know, it's also possibly a reflection of myself as well. I've always had friends from many different walks of life in New York. And I just genuinely felt as though I had a very good and strong kind of rapport with my friends here. And in fact, in New York City, many of my closest friends were Icelandic. And so many of my closest friends in New York City were, in fact, Icelandic or part Icelandic or married to an Icelander. And, you know, that was kind of part of my circle there.
I could have done my research, but is the punk rocker John Narr still the mayor of Reykjavik, or is that already long gone?
No, he's no longer the mayor here, although that was a very interesting time for sure. He's brilliant and an incredible comedian and also I think did some fantastic things as mayor when he was here, but he's no longer the mayor today.
Okay. So at some point you ended up in the space industry.
Yeah.
Was there any formal training on your end?
Well, was there any formal training on my end before entering the space sector? I can tell you that from a very young age, I was captivated and inspired by space exploration, like many children all over the globe. And growing up in the United States in the 80s, there was a very focused initiative for STEAM engagement in the public primary schools. And that was definitely part of the spark, which lit the fire for space for me. I remember going to the Air and Space Museum multiple times with my parents. I remember doing work at a after school program where they made a mock space station where they had microscopes and telescopes and even early computers where we were learning to program. And I had my like NASA flight jacket, you know, like so many children who were inspired back then. But I ultimately took a creative course through school. I went to the Rhode Island School of Design and I majored in film and interactive design at RISD. And I actually ran a production company in New York City for many years. But space technology, space research was always a fundamental inspiration for me. And when I finally moved to Iceland, I thought I'd be doing film production work. But in fact, I was doing a lot of work in these extreme locations, these extreme and remote locations here in Iceland. I was leading and planning expeditions here and spending a lot of time on the glacier with my partner, Gunnar Gudjonsson. And we were testing this giant glacial expedition vehicle and then helping researchers gain access to very hard to reach locations here in Iceland. And the more time I spent in these locations, the more of a kind of an expert on the ground I became on these field sites. And the more I began to learn about the geology and the fauna and the different types of geological processes that the geological processes that exist in these locations. And ultimately, had the opportunity to give a lecture at ESTEC about the terrestrial analogs of Iceland and the potential of research partnerships, researchers coming to Iceland to do research and how they can partner with boots on the ground in order to connect the dots for logistical and research support. And in fact, after that that talk, a number of researchers came to Iceland and I said, okay, where do we start? You know, where do we sign up? Who's the point of contact? And the reality is that there was nothing really set up here. So every time research teams came to Iceland, they would always start from zero. You know, maybe there was a company before, that company is no longer, they're starting off with a new company. There was no nexus for engagement with the local research community. There were certainly relationships that individual researchers had with researchers at NASA and the European Space Agency. And I think it was well known that there was expertise here in Iceland. That's not something that I created or, you know, discovered. But as far as there being a hub and a point of contact in order to connect the dots and bring things together, that hadn't existed yet. So we started slowly organizing this with researchers on the ground and guides and putting together what is the infrastructure that exists here? What is the infrastructure that's needed? And how can we ultimately bring something to the table so that better science can be done and there can be a higher return on the science that is executed here in Iceland? And over that time, as we were developing relationships with researchers from the U.S. and from Europe, slowly we began to organize this Iceland Space Agency. And it happened very organically. And, you know, this is something that is still growing and developing to this day. And I think that there has been some fantastic developments over the last year specifically. And it's been an exciting time where we can really demonstrate how Iceland is really a very important part of the global discourse around space exploration research.
This is really fascinating on many levels, because what I really love about it, it gives the passion a voice, and not only academia being super important. And I'm not speaking against the traditional academic route through physics and astrophysics or whatnot to becoming the director of a space agency. I think what is captivating about your career path is that someone was bold enough to give you the opportunity by seeing your passion for a project, for something, to set up that agency. And that is really forward-looking, in my opinion, because it widens the pool of talent, in my opinion. If you're also bold enough to look outside academia. So that's really forward-looking. Well, whoever was responsible for that.
Well, I can say that there are certainly many people that have been responsible on my path and where I am today. And I certainly stand on the shoulders of many experts and PhDs and researchers who have done fantastic work here in Iceland over many, many decades. And Iceland is such a fantastic reserve of academic expertise with regards to the terrestrial analogs that we all hold so dear and like to talk about, as far as astronaut training locations, and telerobotics, and planetary research that's really informing the future of space exploration. And although many of those researchers here in Iceland may not call themselves planetary scientists, may not call themselves planetary researchers, they are, in fact, by offering their knowledge and doing the research they're doing on planet Earth, they are, in fact, informing the type of research and exploration being done on other planets. I am really little more than a conduit that's taking a look at, this is what exists. Here's the research that is coming here. Here's the opportunity for technology to be developed and to be tested here. And here are the experts in industry, in the universities, that can really offer something and that can also really benefit the greater society, both here in Iceland and abroad. Because as I like to say, it is about inspiring future generations to reach for the stars. What I like to say is that it is ultimately about inspiring future generations to reach for the stars, but to also better understand and protect the Earth beneath our feet. And that is really fundamental for what we're doing long term here in Iceland with the Iceland Space Agency.
Which planetary diverse experiences can Iceland offer? So what planets can you offer? I guess they talk a lot about Mars. They may talk a little bit about the moon. So what's on the plate, on the menu, when space people want to go look for inspiration for missions maybe in Iceland?
You know, Iceland has the most diverse set of terrestrial analogs in close proximity to one another that exists anywhere on Earth. We have equatorial Mars. We have polar Mars. We have the moon, the south pole of the moon. We have Venus. We have Europa. We have researchers looking at Iceland to test technology for Titan. And, you know, that's not even to mention the exploration and missions going to asteroids. So Iceland is very important, well beyond just the kind of the, if you will, standard Mars and lunar, missions. Iceland really has a treasure trove of field science that are really important for better understanding other heavenly bodies in general.
When you mentioned the different planetary places in Iceland in very close vicinity, I immediately pictured not only myself, but also fellow nerd tourists to do planetary visits to Iceland, to visit, I don't know, Venus and the moon in the morning and Mars and Pluto in the afternoon. Wouldn't that be a thing for you?
Oh, absolutely. I'm so glad you brought this up because, you know, in addition to the very important research that's being conducted here, we also believe very strongly in the purpose to inspire outside of the science community and really engage the broader public as citizen scientists so that people can come here and actually contribute in a meaningful way to the research and the technology development that's being done here. And that's why the Ice and Space Agency developed experiential research expeditions. And we actually launched this initiative with Adventure X, Matt Pryor and his team, to test the MS2 Moon Mars Analog Spacesuit Simulator. And we took that simulator to lunar analogs, to Martian analogs, to lava tubes on the glacier, and really to a vast and diverse array of terrestrial analogs here in Iceland. And I think it served as an important template for how responsible tourism can be done that also really contributes to research in a meaningful way and really moves the ball forward in terms of what may be possible on other planets, while also giving citizen scientists or adventure tourists the ability to participate and to better understand the type of work that's being done and to really be a part of it. And that's really important for us here in Iceland, as tourism is a big part of our GDP. It's the biggest sector of GDP here in Iceland. So being able to bring that community into the research realm and to do so in a responsible and sustainable fashion is very important. And I think for that.
So where would I sign up for that?
Well, I can certainly send you a link to sign up for that. I can also, I'm very happy to share that the cover photo for the 35th anniversary of Condé Nast Traveler, The Future of Travel, featured a photograph from that MS2 ERE1 expedition that we did. And I can send you a link to that cover and some articles about that expedition. Awesome. And the future expeditions that we're planning for citizen scientists to come and participate in space research. Space tourism doesn't only have to be in low Earth orbit. It can be right here and contribute in a meaningful way to what we know about our own planet.
What's your favorite place? Your personal favorite place?
My favorite place? That's a really tough question. What is my favorite place in Iceland? Well, I would say one of my favorite locations in Iceland is Þórsmörk. Þórsmörk is a really incredible location, which is tucked between a number of volcanoes and glaciers. And you have the most incredible convergence of geomorphic processes and geological circumstance that's created literally a heaven on Earth. So from the volcanism to the glaciers, to the waterfalls, and even the forests and hot springs, it really is a very special place.
Wow. I visited Iceland, I think, 25 years ago. But in geologic terms, I think that's pretty much nothing. I visited that beautiful place, Þingvellir. Mm-hmm. I think it is called, where you get to walk in this canyon where the Eurasian and American tectonic plates touch one another.
No, that's right. Þingvellir National Park is a really stunning location, and it's most well known for being that location where you have the diverging tectonic plates, the North American and the Eurasian continental plate coming apart. And this seam actually bisects the entire landmass of Iceland. And you can see expressions of this on the surface in many locations in Iceland, but in no place more so than at Þingvellir National Park, where you can, in fact, walk between that divide And Iceland, in fact, is growing to this day, an average rate of about 6 centimeters a year. And that's because in addition to being exactly at the seam between the continental plates, it's also directly on top of the hottest mantle plume on the planet, which is an area where magma is flowing up between the crust. And that's the reason ultimately for our volcanism. That's the reason for our abundance of geothermal energy, and also the reason why we have glaciers here.
What's the Icelandic Space Agency most special for? So what are you specializing in?
There's no question that Iceland has a lot to offer on many fronts, from expertise in energy management, specifically geothermal and hydroelectric, to in-situ resource utilization, how you use the resources here in remote and harsh climates in order to live a more sustainable and profitable existence, and also the incredible expertise around AI and machine learning. The data centers that exist here are also a result of the abundance of energy and the cooler climate. But the most important factor for the Iceland Space Agency and really our specialty and our expertise and the thing that we leverage most is the terrestrial analogs that we have, the natural resources we have, which are similar to, have characteristics and attributes that can be found on other worlds in our solar system, the planetary research that can be done at these locations, the technology that can be tested and developed at these sites, and also the fantastic amount of astronaut training that has taken place here really since the dawn of the space age, when in 1965 and 1967, all the original Apollo astronauts came here to Iceland to conduct geological field research for what they expected to find on the surface of the moon. And since then, researchers from NASA and the European Space Agency have continued to come here. The technology associated with the Perseverance rover, which is at Jezero crater on the Martian surface today, was tested here prior to launch. The Dick Mars team, who we worked very closely with, Dr. Michael Thorpe from NASA Goddard Space Flight Center, and Dr. Elizabeth Rampe from Johnson Space Center, they were here with the Dick Mars team assessing locations that they believe are similar to what existed on the Martian surface 3.5 billion years ago. The Artemis astronaut training team was also here last summer and the summer before. So there's a lot of work to be done here. And there's a lot of interest in Iceland as it relates very specifically to our terrestrial analogs and the expertise that exists here in Iceland, the knowledge base about these sites, and our ability to uniquely access and provide logistical and research support for the research teams coming here. That's really our strong suit and what we have to offer.
Daniel, how does that feel to you? We talk quite a bit about your passion for science, for space. How does that feel to you to go to a place that literally is pretty much similar to Mars a couple of billion years ago and be able to touch it, although it not being Mars? But how does that feel to you personally? What goes through your head?
You know, people often talk about the overview effect, right? Going to low Earth orbit, looking back down on our planet and having this epiphany of how fragile our world is and how in awe the majesty of nature can be. And I think here in Iceland on the ground, when you go to the top of our glaciers or explore our lava tubes, or the basalt lava fields, I think there's a similar condition that you also feel. It's obviously not the overview effect. We're not looking down on Earth, but we are right at the really right at the core of Mother Earth. We're seeing all these processes in their rawest form, from erupting volcanoes to ice caves melting to the waterfalls. And all of these processes together, when you combine them in terms of an experience of traveling through our country, you really do get a very special appreciation for our own planet. That is difficult. It's difficult to put into words, honestly, until you're here. But when I've never been to low Earth orbit looking down on our planet, but when I hear astronauts talking about this, I do feel as though I can identify to some extent in terms of the experiences that I've had here in Iceland.
Maybe I could imagine if I were in your shoes, walking these lava fields, glaciers, whatnot, to be in awe of the simple fact that you are walking primordial Earth now and then. And this is a place where there was no life around. And at some point, something happened on this place that you're walking on that through some kind of magic or whatever that was, something started to replicate. And isn't that utterly fascinating to see dead matter at the same time being energized by those raging forces, creating something that is the basis of our communication we're having right now? That's awe-inspiring. That's, to me, that overview effect from the surface.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, you know, another thing that I was speaking to one of my colleagues a few weeks ago about the fantastic research being done in Greenland as well. You know, in Greenland, just across the water in the north, we have some of the oldest rocks, some of the oldest bedrock on Earth. And not very far away, almost in eyeshot, we have some of the youngest bedrock on the planet. Iceland, relatively speaking, is quite young. It's about 16 million years old. From a planetary perspective, that's quite young. I often see, I don't know if you've seen this Pangaea map, where they show where all the countries would be on Pangaea when the giant landmass was all together before the continental plates took them and spread them apart.
Drifted apart.
Yeah, and often on that map, I'll see Iceland. And that is as false as you can get.
Can be.
Iceland didn't exist then. You know, Iceland was born only 16 million years ago. And so I think this incredible convergence of raw nature, of having both volcanic eruptions and glaciers, having the waterfalls and the black rocks and the green fields. It's these extremes that exist at the same time here in Iceland, the perpetual night, the perpetual day, in the summertime. It's all of these extremes together in one place that, that make Iceland so special and really do give you that very unique perspective on our own planet where you can see all these extremes coming together in a very close-knit community and environment.
Does it make life difficult for you, for human beings? Is Iceland a place for special individuals only?
That's a good question.
Specialized individuals.
There's no question that from the time I was very young, I certainly gravitated towards extremes, extreme subcultures, extreme environments, from, you know, snowboarding or, you know, riding bicycles with no brakes or, you know, I remember planning my first bicycle trip across Iceland. You know, everybody thought I was nuts. I just thought it was something that one would do. Right. So I do think that there certainly are specific people that gravitate towards extreme places. That's true. And we're also familiar with, ice training or isolated, confined, extreme environments, which is a type of training that, astronauts do, and are done a lot of, analog, or concept operations where simulate missions on other worlds, right? We have to be in these extreme environments to understand how we'll work together and how we'll also be able to navigate, very harsh circumstances, both from a psychological perspective and also from a physical and environmental perspective. And there's no question that Iceland is a great place, for doing that type of work, and that just living here, it does take a special person to come here and stay, you know, to visit, you know, no problem. But, you know, you do have to be perhaps a more unique individual to come here and stay for a longer period of time. But, you know, the Vikings, did it starting, you know, 890 AD. And they did it without a whole lot of help, or technology at the time, incredibly harsh, in fact, in some cases, harsher, conditions, from a mini ice age to many deadly, volcanic eruptions. So the culture here, definitely evolved under extreme circumstance. And so the cultural psyche of Iceland, and the ability to persevere and explore in those difficult circumstances is also something that's quite inspiring and special. You know, there's a reason why, you know, the Icelandic national soccer team, for example, beat England, in the Euro Cup, some years ago, you know, a country of, you know, 365,000 people. And I think it's a testament to that cultural psyche, that allows for, the seemingly impossible, to take place. And I think for that reason, it's also, the conditions that make it perfect, to be able to offer some insight on how we can explore and go deeper into our solar system and explore other heavenly bodies, that may in fact be quite harsh and extreme, to life.
Speaking of the soccer team, the Icelandic soccer team, that war dance became a meme, a global meme. Is that a traditional thing to do, or was that just made up?
I remember it distinctly. Yeah. I remember participating in it.
Participating in it.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, the whole country, I think, participated in that kind of, chant. How exactly it started, I wouldn't be able to tell you. But it seemed quite natural at the time. I could say that.
Yeah. It did, and did its job. They beat England. So, period.
Yeah. Yeah.
What are the major projects that are currently, are going on at the space agency?
Oh, thank you for asking. I mentioned already a little bit about the NASA Dig Mars project, which was led by Dr. Michael Thorpe at the Goddard Space Flight Center and Dr. Elizabeth Rampe. That was, this past summer. It was a team of, 20 researchers here in country who doing fantastic work. An analysis on samples, core samples from lakes around Iceland. These sites are considered analogous to what Mars may have been like 3.5 billion years ago when there was water flowing on the surface. And these samples are also in helping us better understand how similar processes on the Martian surface may have led to habitability, the potential of habitability, the potential of where ancient Martian life could have existed at some of these locations that the Perseverance rover is exploring to this day, and taking samples that will eventually be sent back to Earth with Mars sample return. So that's one project, the NASA Dig Mars project that we worked on both this past summer and the summer before. Another project that we've been working on for the last few years is with PI Dr. Angelica Engles from the Blue Marble Space Institute of Science. And that's the Iceland Space Agency IMS-LDS project, which stands for Iceland Moon Mars Simulation Life Detection Strategies. And Dr. Engles has been working with us to survey and look at potential analog sites here in Iceland with a specific focus on habitability and how the conditions here in Iceland can inform the work on the Martian surface and future exploration of Mars. And that project also has the participation of Dr. Mitch Schulte, who's program scientist at NASA headquarters for Mars 2020. And we were actually in the field with them just this past summer. We'll be again in the future for sure. That project led to our invitation to the International Mars Exploration Working Group meeting in Turin, Italy, this past September, where we met with some of the greatest minds doing Martian research on the ground today from various space agencies, including NASA, European Space Agency, and really from across the globe. And it was a fantastic meetup where we discussed research, we discussed future projects, and how we can all work together and really pool resources to better understand what's possible on the Martian surface and how we can leverage analogs like those that exist in Iceland to really better understand what future work can be done there. In addition to that, we've been working with Professor Michael Lai for since 2019 to develop the IMS-MS2 Moon Mars Spacesuit Simulator. And that's a physical spacesuit simulator that's based on Artemis generation geometry, which is used and will be used more for future training of astronauts on the surface here in Iceland. We had the honor of also working with Adventure X and Matt Pryor and his team to further test that spacesuit simulator here last summer. And, I think it really charted a path for how future research and development can be done here in Iceland with the support of interested parties from abroad.
Beautiful.
Also developing the broader IMS R&D initiative, which includes a habitat that's being developed and that will be deployed at our analogs here in Iceland, and working with partners in Europe as well for their architecture and infrastructure, which may be a part of the habitat and concept operations, which we're currently developing here in Iceland. So we're working on a pretty broad array of initiatives that also includes STEM and STEAM engagement, and how we inspire future generations here in Iceland to reach for the stars while better understanding, protecting their Earth beneath our feet. And we're working very closely with the Ministry of Higher Education, Science and Innovation, specifically Minister Auslug Artna, who's been very supportive of this new space initiative for Iceland and really believes and understands on how important space is and support for space, not only for the work that can be done off planet, but really how it informs and benefits us all here on planet Earth. So we're very excited about the projects we've been working on and the researchers we've had the honor of working with over the years. Support from members of the Explorers Club and how they've also contributed in a big way in helping to bring together researchers and sponsors who can really understand and help move things forward here in Iceland, but also all across the globe. Mm-hmm. Dr. Angelica Engels has been a big part of connecting those dots with, for example, the Explorers Club Hong Kong chapter. And that's also made a big difference in the projects we've been working on.
Hmm. Seems like you got a huge headquarter in Iceland for all things space, especially when it comes to finding life on other places, gearing up for human missions on different places.
Absolutely. And you know, one thing I didn't even get to mention, one item is the incredible array of lava tubes that we have here. And the discussion around lava tubes as it relates to both habitability of potential habitability of alien life and also the potential of human habitability on the surface of Moon, on the surface of Mars, and how natural structures like lava tubes can shield humans and life from the harmful cosmic and solar radiation.
Radiation.
Yeah. And so
how big are those tubes?
Here in Iceland, we actually worked for a long time during Enlightenment specifically. We have the longest lava tube in the world. We have probably, I couldn't tell you exactly the comparison of lava tubes here with lava tubes in other places such as Hawaii, for example, but the diversity and spectrum length and size of the lava tubes we have are important for how life could potentially exist on other planets such as Mars. And although the lava tubes here comparatively would be much smaller than they would exist on the Moon or Mars because of gravitational factors, they're still big enough that you could, and we have in fact deployed concept operations within them to test technology and surface infrastructure that could one day be used on other planets.
What are the odds that we will find traces of life on Mars? Is that still being debated, or is it just a question of time that we will find it?
Well, this is a good question. I'm not an astrobiologist, so I'm not going to wade too far into these questions. It's really a question better asked to researchers such as Dr. Angelica Engels or Dr. Jennifer Blank at NASA Ames, for example. Sure. I personally believe there is a potential to find signs of ancient Martian life. I think that there is a good possibility of that. From a layman's perspective. And I think that lava tubes would be a good place to look, as we can see that life exists in lava tubes here in Iceland under conditions that one would not expect life to be thriving. And yet it does. And so, you know, life finds a way. And life finds a way in the harshest and most extreme environments that exist here on Earth. So then, is it not possible that life could exist in other places and in similar fashions? And I believe we will find life on other planets. Exactly where, exactly how, or when remains to be seen. But I think Iceland will be informing how and where that life could be found. Mm. And that's very exciting.
Mm. Are there any plans for Iceland, for the Iceland Space Agency, to also invest in launching systems? Would that make any sense?
The location that Iceland is on the globe, there's certainly the potential to launch rockets into polar orbit and to also observe satellites which have polar orbits, as well as ground confirmation, navigation, uplink and downlink stations that are retrieving data or sending signals to polar orbiting satellites. And in fact, in 1964, CNASA, the French space agency, was launching sounding rockets to better understand and learn about the Van Allen belt. And just last winter, there was a team from NASA here looking at sounding rockets that were being shot into the cusp region, or the hole in the magnetosphere. So as it relates to research around the magnetosphere, around the aurora, heliogeophysics, the relationship between our star and our planet, there's certainly a fantastic opportunity to both launch and observe, to conduct science relative to heliogeophysics, and also with regards to polar orbiting satellites, and also really contribute to our understanding of debris in low Earth orbit and how we can better mitigate and understand the debris that exists by observing and processing the data here in Iceland. Mm-hmm. I mentioned earlier that the data centers that can be built here, the potential for the data centers, the potential for high power computing and machine learning to better understand and to crunch the big data coming in, and that's necessary to understand satellites and debris in low Earth orbit. This is fundamental in a place where Iceland can really contribute. In terms of Iceland being a launch state and having a sustainable, you know, spaceport activities, I think that remains to be seen. Again, we're pretty far from the equator. We also have some weather conditions that aren't always favorable for launch windows. Mm-hmm. But that said, there is also tremendous work that can be done in terms of launches here with specific focus.
Absolutely. You mentioned data centers. Is it true that Iceland is especially a good place for data centers for its cooling, natural cooling abilities?
No question. I mean, we have an abundance of water. We have an abundance of geothermal and hydroelectric energy. We are, generally speaking, a very cool climate. So, that's definitely a huge asset. So with regards to data centers, high power computing, quantum computing, machine learning, and big data, Iceland is certainly a really important
place to go.
Yeah. We're actually working very closely with an initiative called the Reykjavik Institute, which is being run by Kaiser Global, and they're working on plans for a pretty advanced center here that will be doing some pretty groundbreaking work in the future.
Beautiful. And Daniel, what can the world learn from Iceland? And I'm keeping it intentionally very open. Mm-hmm. You can focus now on the space world or on the issues we're having in the world. What is it that we can learn from Iceland?
I think one of the most important things that we can learn from the research being conducted here in Iceland is that there's a lot of talk about the commercial satellite and launch sector. There's a lot of talk about in situ resource utilization on other planets. And there's also debate about why we should be focused on leaving Earth when there are so many problems here. And I think what Iceland can really contribute globally to this discourse around space is the importance of Earth, the importance of the work and the research and the technological development that can be done here on our own planet that will inform what's done on other worlds, but that ultimately will benefit us most right here in our own backyard. And I think that for me, that's also really one of the most inspiring components, is that I'm not thinking about going to the moon. I'm not thinking about going to Mars personally. I'm thinking about how Iceland can contribute to our understanding of those places, and how that understanding will ultimately contribute to how we can live a more sustainable existence right here, and how the technology being developed for other worlds can also benefit us most right here in Iceland. And when you think about climate change, global warming, here in the Arctic, this is a big issue. I've been watching myself, these glaciers retreat at a fantastic pace. I have seen with my own eyes a glacial retreat of 250 meters in a single year. A single year.
In a year.
In a year. In a wow. year.
Wow.
And I think you have to get your head around that. And that doesn't happen every year, and it doesn't happen in every location. But it's startling. It's terrifying. And when you see this in real time, in addition to the awe, the majesty, the beauty of Iceland, there's also a distinct horror and a terror about, you know, what if we don't do what we need to do in order to pass a healthy planet onto the next generation? I think about my daughters. So I'd be excited for my daughters to be astronauts and exploring other worlds. But I'd also be just as excited about them, you know, figuring out the next technology, which is ultimately going to help us live a more sustainable existence on our own planet. And I think the two things are not mutually exclusive. They can be one and the same. And I think with the Iceland Space Agency, the research that we're doing here on Earth, in terms of Earth observation, in terms of climate change and technology developed for other planets that will serve us here, that will help us grow produce more effectively here, that'll help us use water more effectively and generate energy more efficiently. This is what excites me. And this is what I think is quite unique about the Iceland Space Agency, is that first and foremost, it's about what we have right here on the ground, and how what exists here and the work, the research, the technology that's developed and tested here, how that's going to help us really chart a healthier existence in the future.
Dan, can you give me a shot of inspiration? Because this is a coffee place, and in coffee places, you now and then love to have an espresso to energize your body. But now let's have an espresso for the mind. What is it that you would like to share with our audiences to energize them, to inspire them? You can pick whatever kind of topic you want to pick.
One of the first times that I got to visit a glacier was with my very close friend, colleague, and partner, Gunnar Gudjensen, who is one of the most experienced guides and glacial guides in all of Iceland, and is really a fundamental part of the Iceland Space Agency, and offered the earliest support for our initiatives. And when he brought me up to Langjökull Glacier for the first time, and I spent time with him on this vast frozen tundra and watching the sun in a perpetual sunset, a magic hour that lasted literally for hours at the top of the glacier, at the glacier reflecting that beautiful magic hour light. There was a moment there where I realized that this country, that this place has something to offer the world that very few places that I've visited really has the potential to. And that if we all work together in these difficult environments, these dangerous environments, that ultimately we can all feel safe. I felt perfectly safe up on this glacier. A very harsh, dangerous environment, but I felt perfectly safe because I ultimately trusted in my friend Gunnar, and he trusted in his colleagues and the guides that we were all with. And we didn't have a concern in the world. We knew what the dangers were, and we knew what we needed to be aware of and how we needed to be prepared and the equipment we needed, etc. But working together, we can feel perfectly safe in the most dangerous of places. And if that's the case, then certainly this location, Iceland, could certainly demonstrate that to a broader audience and can also inspire them at the same time. That perpetual sunset, that magic hour, that glistening golden light in this fragile and frigid world with, some of your closest friends and most experienced guides. It's a special experience and something that I'm very excited to be able to share with researchers who are coming here, astronauts who are looking to train here, aerospace engineers who are looking to test, or roboticists who are looking to test technology here. To do it here is not only practical or serves a scientific purpose. It serves the purpose of helping to inspire through process, to inspire through science, and to engage a broader audience in the importance of both space and Earth science, and how we can ultimately live on this little blue marble together, and chart a path for a healthier future.
Wonderful, Daniel. We're in the process of setting up a Spotify playlist for future space travelers, because space travel will be a pretty boring thing for the most part, because it's very long traveling. So people will want to bring a little bit of entertainment. What's the one tune you wouldn't want to miss on your space trip to Mars? And I'm literally putting it on the Space Cafe podcast guest tunes playlist.
Jean-Michel Jarre, Oxygen, two and four at least.
Oxygen, two, four. Okay. Wonderful.
And did that make any sense, what I was saying, or did I just kind of ramble?
Absolutely.
Did it?
No.
Okay. Because I was kind of crafting this as I was saying it. I wasn't sure if it was following a logical thread.
Usually, as a storyteller, and we have similar origins, because I'm also in the film industry. I'm a filmmaker. We know that sometimes it's beneficial to de-rationalize our thoughts and let the unconscious take over. That produces the novel ideas. So rambling has benefits, I should say.
Yeah. And I'll leave you with an important saying here, the Iceland Space Agency, Frá Íslandi upp í himingi, which means from Iceland to the stars.
Excellent. No words.
Thank you all for listening today. Please visit spacewatch.global and make sure you check out the latest episodes of the Space Cafe radio shows that will keep you up to date on the latest news from space and its surroundings. And please consider leaving a review for this podcast on iTunes or Spotify. It's, by the way, most convenient on a smartphone rather than on your desktop. It's super easy. Thanks for your loyalty. It means a lot to us, and we mean it. And we look forward to seeing you next time. Stay close and stay safe, my friends. Bye-bye.